This episode, I'm joined once again by Mark Sedgwick to discuss the life and work of Ivan Egeli, primarily from the book Anarchist, Artist, Sufi, The Politics, Painting, and Esotericism of Ivan Egeli. I'd like to say a big thank you to my paying patrons and subscribers for making all of this work possible. If you'd like to support the podcast and keep everything running as it runs from patronage alone, please find links in the description below. Otherwise, please enjoy. So, Mark Sedgwick, thanks once again for joining us on Hermetics Podcast. We are going to be discussing a book which was published in 2021, Anarchist, Artist, Sufi, The Politics, Painting, and Esotericism of Ivan Egeli. And this was published by Bloomsbury and was part of the Islam of the Global West series. Now, Ivan Egeli was an anarchist, an artist, a Sufi, and this book contains a series of papers on his life, his work, his esotericism, and there's you edited the collection, and also there is a contribution by yourself relating to Egeli in relation to traditionalism. So as I understand it from my research, so correct me if I'm wrong here, this seems to be the first major English appreciation of Egeli's work as a whole. Would that be correct?
Yeah, no, that is correct. I mean, there's little on him in Swedish, but generally focusing on his role as an artist and not really looking at the other things. Tiny bit in French, and until now there was nothing in English, which is one of the reasons why I thought we should do this book.
And I have a feeling there's a sort of, maybe this is a beginning of a renaissance of Egeli, or is this really, would you argue perhaps this is the first finding?
Yeah, I mean, we'll see where it goes. This is something I've been wanting to do for years, and now that I've done it, I'm sort of signing off on Egeli myself. If anybody else wants to go further with this, that would be really great.
So where did you first discover Egeli?
I first discovered him, when I first discovered traditionalism and Guénard and all that, because he's the guy who introduced René Guénard to Sufism. So he turns up in the first ever biography of Guénard, which is the right one, which was written by Jacques Cornac in the 1950s. In those days, that was when I was still living in Cairo myself. So the story of this sweet Swedish painter in Cairo really sort of appealed.
So I don't normally ask such overarching and, I will admit, asinine questions, but because he's such a small figure, with really, in a way, such a small, you know, this book being really the first major appreciation where we get all the aspects of his life. Why is he who is he of interest to, and why is he of interest?
I think he's of interest because Guénard and traditionalism are of interest. And an awful lot of traditionalism, of what Guénard developed and other people took further, starts with him. And I think he's also interesting in a way because he is one of the first Europeans to convert to Islam, and one of a number of artists. I mean, there are a few other artists, mostly French, who also convert to Islam in this period. So that gives him a certain role in the history of Islam in Europe, especially the history of Islam in Scandinavia.
And speaking of Scandinavia, and speaking of this background, I mean, it's something that really intrigued me, because he's a name that's often all about the place, which is the British. Well, the English would pronounce it Swedenborg, but as my Swedish friend has told me, it's more like, and I'll mispronounce this because Swedish pronunciation is beyond me, but something along Emanuel Swedenberg, something along those lines.
I think he's been around for long enough and is famous enough for the English version of his name to be current.
Well, my Swedish friend always he'll repronounce it just to annoy me. So, but we'll go with Swedenborg for this conversation.
Yeah, let's
But
go with it.
Swedenborg is a name that you'll see throughout the history of esotericism. I guess you'll also see it throughout the history of philosophy in very peculiar places, such as the work of Immanuel Kant. But that whole history has been pushed aside because it's pre-critique. But what role there seems to be a spiritual progression through in Egeli's life from the new church of Swedenborg through to Theosophy, and then sort of a hard stop in Sufism. He finds something there. But, you know, what role does the Swedenborgian spiritual appreciation play for Egeli? And does he sort of take some seeds from that all the way through, you know, through his entire life?
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, Swedenborg, is as you say, he crops up everywhere because he is one of the earliest and most interesting people in Europe to, I hesitate over interesting, but it's also difficult, we have to admit, but that can be an advantage too. He's one of the earliest and most interesting Europeans to write about mysticism and esotericism and so forth. So in some ways, it's not surprising that he had an impact on Egeli, on the young Egeli.
Mm-hmm.
And he, in his first impact on the young Egeli, Egeli himself said, was to take him, to cure him of Protestantism. and what he also got from Swedenborg as a young man was the idea of a pure monotheism. Mm-hmm. Not the Trinity, but a pure monotheism. And a pure monotheism which in some ways expressed itself in terms of light. And light was, of course, very important for him as a painter, but also light is a symbol of knowledge and wisdom and the divine and so forth. That comes from Swedenborg. And in a sense, as you say, he then went through Theosophy and he ended up in Sufism. But he never really changed what he was doing in one way. He was looking for this pure monotheism. He often refers to this pure monotheism. So his goal was the same.
Mm-hmm.
And he never dropped Swedenborg. He never really dropped Theosophy either.
Mm-hmm.
But I think each stage was a step further in the same direction for him. So when he's in his Sufi phase, he's still referring to Swedenborg.
I have to ask, what is it to be cured of Protestantism?
I don't know. It gets even more complicated because actually he said he was cured of Protestantism and Germanism. And I'm not quite sure how one gets cured of Germanism. And I've never really found, I mean, clearly at the time there was some idea that to be a real Swede, one had to be a real Swede rather than a sort of German Swede, because Germany were very close together intellectually and culturally and even linguistically. But I think now, I mean, to be cured from Protestantism for him probably really means to be cured from the superficialities of conventional Protestantism, to be freed to access what was really important, which is the pure monotheism.
Did you enjoy the coronation? I shouldn't make that joke, but there we go. Okay, so the then we have the curing of Protestantism away from its superficiality along this thread of Swedenborg to Theosophy to Sufism, which the thread remains all the way in a pure monotheism, which is taken very sincerely. So why the stop at Sufism, and what is his entry into Islam? You know, I guess the big question is, what wasn't there before in Swedenborg and Theosophy, which suddenly, maybe if it was sudden, was there in Islam?
I mean, okay, so I mean, firstly, the one of the things which is interesting about Hegeli is that when we're looking at Westerners and Sufism and Islam, very, very often we find that they become Sufis and therefore become Muslim.
Okay.
That's the standard pattern. Now, Hegeli does not follow that standard pattern. He became Muslim first, and then a few years later, got into Sufism, which they say is unusual. And I think one of the reasons why so many Westerners get into Sufism and therefore become Muslim is because they recognize in Sufi theology some of the mysticism that they've already discovered elsewhere. And I mean, this was true of Hegeli as well. I mean, he said when he started reading the great Sufi mystic Ibn Arabi, he said he wrote to his mother that this was rather like Swedenborg. So he did, as many other people have done, recognized mysticism and in some ways probably Neoplatonic mysticism. But for him, what came first was Islam. And what he found in Islam was not initially mysticism. It was this pure monotheism. Because you know, Islam is very clear on there being one God and only one God. I mean, this is the beginning of the confession of faith. No? So clearly he liked that very much. And I think he also liked the purity and the simplicity of Islam. And this, at that point, he was a theosophist. And, I mean, theosophy, I don't think even theosophy's fans would claim that it was pure and simple.
No, they tend to fly all over the place, and then
they do, don't they?
And then they all people like Steiner or whoever, they all sort of regret it later. No one ever says I was happy I was in theosophy.
Often it is exactly it's a road to something else. But so I think he liked the purity and the simplicity of Islam, and then later when he actually encountered Sufism. He encountered living Sufism in Egypt with a Sufi master. And that means that he, for the first time, perhaps, encountered mysticism in practice, in use, not just in theory. And that, I think, was very important for him. So that's what each stage is adding. You say it comes to a full stop with Sufism. That might have been because he thought that he'd got where he wanted to get. It might also have been because he settled in Egypt and then actually died fairly soon afterwards, because he died quite young. He did actually start to get interested in Taoism when he was in Egypt for many years as a Sufi and as a journalist, and then he lost his job and he went back to Paris for a bit, which is where he met Guénon and had an impact that we might perhaps talk about later. And then he went briefly back to Egypt again. Things didn't really work out. First World War starts. He's penniless. He's cut off from Europe. And he's expelled by the Egyptian authorities on the advice of the British. But in that brief period in Paris with Guénon, Guénon's interested in Taoism. And Hegeli begins to get interested in Taoism, but here it's on a theoretical level again. There's no indication that he ever thought, okay, I'm now going to drop this Sufism and try Taoism instead. He definitely did reach his destination in Sufism.
So I just want to jump back a little bit and perhaps define the difference for Ageli between, and generally, what the difference between a pure and impure monotheism would be. Or am I getting you in hot water with that?
No. I mean, we're allowed to be rude about Protestantism, are we?
Yeah, that's, sure.
That's, I mean, following Ageli. Ageli didn't really like Protestantism. Mm. And he... Clearly, I mean, he didn't like Protestant. He grew up in a little town in central Sweden, and he didn't really like small town central Sweden either. And I think I can imagine that it may not have been the most fun place to grow up. So I mean, impure monotheism. Well, I mean, clearly that means the Trinity.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, I think it means the mixture of Protestantism with sort of bourgeois respectability and the possibly somewhat stifling atmosphere of his early years.
Mm-hmm.
But also, remember, he's a painter.
Mm-hmm.
And light is important to him as a painter. And it's important as a symbol of divine knowledge. And there are two in his painting career. He's fascinated with light throughout it. But at the beginning, he's painting on the Swedish island of Gotland, where there is a certain, very clear, because of the sea around it, there's a certain very clear but very northern light. And then when he gets to Egypt, he has this incredibly strong, at one point he calls it African light. And I mean, you know, technically, yes, Egyptians don't think they're African, but it is in the African continent. So that wasn't wrong. But there's this incredibly strong light, which is a light that he finds in many ways to be pure.
Mm.
And it flattens everything. It is so strong that it flattens everything. Mm-hmm. So I think that we've got our pure monotheism, which he identifies with the incredibly strong light of Egypt, which happens also to be the place where he's discovering Sufism. So somehow those three all come together there.
So the light, the northern light had become murky and didn't work as well. Hmm. That's interesting. So, was he always an artist from sort of a young age?
He started painting as a young man, so as a child almost, and of course his father, who was the local vet, thought that it would be a lot better if he could do something sort of sensible, but he never really got into doing anything sensible. And he never made it. Died in absolute poverty. So clearly his father was right. Mm-hmm. Although he had become a vet, I doubt we'd be talking about him now. So yeah, he was from very young. He really, really, really wanted to be a painter, and that's what he did. Although there are two periods in his life when he isn't painting.
Mm-hmm.
There's a period when he's in Paris, because he lived in Paris for many years. And he starts writing about painting rather than actually doing it. he becomes an art critic primarily.
Mm-hmm.
And there are no paintings from that period. And then when in the longest period he's spending in Egypt, which is his Sufi period, once again he's writing. But he's writing for not as an art critic, but he's writing on Islam and politics and things like that. And then in his very last few years, he starts painting again.
Mm-hmm.
So the catastrophic last year of his life, when he's poor and hungry and abandoned in Spain, he's producing some amazing paintings. always quite small ones because he can't afford anything larger. But he does. He's a painter at the beginning. He's a painter at the end. So.
Are many of his paintings still existing? Are they collectible? Are they sought after?
Yeah, I mean, I've never heard of any of them outside Sweden. I mean, there was a little exhibition in Paris many years ago in the 70s, I think, like that, something like that. But you can find his paintings in a number of Swedish galleries, and there's people occasionally hold special exhibitions, including his paintings, so you can see them. And if you really don't mind making the trek from Stockholm to the little town he was born in,
mm-hmm.
They've got a collection of his painting in that little town in the Ageli Museum, which sits there waiting for the visitors, because you have to be quite dedicated. Mm. Oh, it's not a long way, but last time I went there was only one direct train every 3 hours. So I don't think there's anything else much to go to that town for.
How do you think he'd feel about the Egyptian light being dragged back to the small town?
I really don't know. By which I mean, I think he might not be entirely happy about that, because he's the most famous son of the town. It's called mm-hmm. Sala. He's the most famous son of Sala, but he kept in touch with his mum, but he never showed any interest at all in returning to Sala. Where he's actually buried, because he died, as I say, in Spain, but his body was repatriated some years later. And he's buried under a little stone with a cross on it.
A Christian cross,
giving mm-hmm. a churchyard in a Christian cross, with mm-hmm. a Christian cross, giving his original Swedish name.
Okay.
Not his Muslim name, Abdul Hadi.
Is there any sort of extant literature as to why that happened? It doesn't seem to make much sense.
Well, I mean, yeah, what happened is simply when he died in Spain, people had gathered that he was in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And a Swedish prince, who was himself a painter, sent some money.
Mm-hmm.
And afterwards collected his paintings, which is why the last paintings still exist and don't get lost. And there was another Swede in Spain who arranged the gravestone. So that's why we have the cross and the original name. So. And then when he was all repatriated to Sweden, it was, you know, just what came from Spain. And I mean, some people in Sweden have periodically raised the question of, shouldn't the poor guy have a proper Muslim gravestone?
Mm-hmm.
Given, you know, that's what he was, that's mm-hmm. that's what he was important as, that's what he was interesting for, as well as that's what he, you know, became and wanted mm-hmm. to be. But hasn't happened.
So, I mean, just to draw on his painting, I spent some time looking at them as I could online, and I noticed they had, you mentioned that the Egyptian light, he understood it, as you said, there is something which makes everything flat. And this certainly does come through in his paintings, that there's a strange sort of immanence, that everything is one, but at the same time he's struggling to just about define things with this very, from the ones I could see, a very, very limited palette. So how I, you know, it's very difficult here just with language. You're not able to actually show the paintings, because I'm, as someone who studied art, I always hated this. You paint a painting and then someone goes, can you explain it to me? Well, it's right there. But if I wanted to explain it to you, I would have written about it. But in what sense does this theological understanding of light influence his understanding of how to paint, of how, I guess, God is
yeah.
in the world?
Yes, well, he didn't really write about his own paintings. I mean, he did actually write about painting and light and pure art and things like that. I mean, but as you say, if he wanted to say what it meant, he would have written about it instead. And there was one occasion on which he was apparently asked whether the layered skies in his earlier compositions reflected a Swedenborgian view of the multiple heavens, to which he apparently said, "No, it's my glasses that make the world look like that." but I mean, I think you can see. I mean, I think you can see that his understanding of what is pure art is visible especially in his later paintings, because he understands pure art as being a representation of the absolute, which is a bit like some of the cubists, perhaps. And he's tending in that direction. So yeah, I think the two do come together there.
So I guess to bring in the third part of the book and the Hegelian trio, in a way, the anarchism, in a way he seems to have a natural tendency towards anarchism, and then in the sense that he you know, looks back and goes, I was cured of Protestantism. Was there perhaps a sort of bit of a disdain for that bureaucratic, you know, a bureaucratic appreciation and approach to things, as opposed to, you know, in art with imagination and creativity, it's very individual approach to things, and an individual understanding of, well, it's the relationship between light and self. It seems the anarchism fits in there quite naturally, but I understand he did meet Kropotkin. So was anarchism in his character, or was it something that was perhaps a bit more just textual?
I think it probably was in his character. I mean, what's very clear is that he wasn't the only artist in Paris in the 1890s who was into anarchism. I mean, in fact, sometimes it feels as if it's a bit more unusual to find an artist who wasn't into anarchism at that point. And this raises the question of the relationship between art and anarchism, which is something that we didn't really address in this book. And if I could go back to it, I might see if we could get something on that. I mean, What is it with art and anarchism? Well, I mean, I think both of them are rejecting the hegemonic views of the world. Both of them. Now, the art is very often trying to penetrate through the hegemonic view to find the real view, to find what's really going on underneath. And I mean, anarchism isn't a research exercise, but it's you know, it is once again a way to penetrate through and produce something else. Both art of that period, certainly, and anarchism are very much counterculture. They're both progressive, and in a sense, both of them are looking for freedom, looking perhaps for absolute freedom, and here actually there's a sort of trio, not just with art and anarchism, but with art, anarchism, and Sufism, because Sufism, you know, like any mysticism, really, is trying to penetrate through the hegemonic, the superficial, and to go for the essential. And for that reason, it is sometimes a bit countercultural. There are some people who see Sufism as necessarily countercultural, which isn't really the case. I mean, Sufism in the Muslim world in the Arab world is often quite established. And, you know, the Sufi master with whom Ageli studied was the son of another Sufi master who'd been an important scholar official. You know, so that's, I mean, Sufi masters and the elite often get a bit intertwined in practice, although they shouldn't really in theory. So Sufism isn't always countercultural; it can be establishment, but there is always somehow something a bit countercultural about it as well. So somehow these three apparently very disparate parts of his life do actually fit logically together.
And for you, that seems to be the thread is freedom.
Yeah. Freedom, light, pure monotheism. Not sure how we can link monotheism to anarchism. But,
well, that's what I was going to say. It's not a modern freedom. It's not a modern freedom.
Well, there we are. You see, that's what changes, I think, a bit over his life is his understanding of freedom. But, I mean, there's still, you know, one of the questions that some people raise is, on the one hand, anarchism is about absolute freedom. And on the other hand, Sufism is about absolute subjection. You subject yourself to your Sufi master and you subject yourself to God.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yes, in some ways these look to be contradictory, but in other ways actually they're not.
Mm-hmm.
Because anarchism objects to the oppression of people by institutions, by humans, by other humans. Anarchism doesn't object to, and anarchism might objects to people acting in the name of God, self-appointed actors in the name of God. But anarchism doesn't necessarily object to God. Anarchism certainly doesn't object to individual morality. And Sufism is, in a sense, based around individual morality, and the Sufi master, the Sheikh, is there as a route to God. In some ways, as a representative of the Prophet, but not really as a representative of God. And also the Sufi master is just, is well, I've been saying Sufi master, but the word that one uses in Arabic is murshid, which means guide. So this your guide is your guide. You are following your guide voluntarily because you think he can get you somewhere. You are not following him because of any form of institutional authority. And he's not part of a sort of church-like institution. As I said, he can sometimes belong to the elite. So there's not quite such a strong contradiction between the two as one might think. But as you say, he ends up with a slightly different sort of freedom because there's the freedom to be yourself. And the freedom to be yourself, your real self, is one of the things that Sufism and other forms of mysticism offer.
Well, I think also modern discussions around freedom have really butchered the word because it's almost as if there's a contemporary belief that freedom could exist in a vacuum, that you could just do anything you want at any point and there's no consequences, repercussions, or sacrifice. Whereas it seems here that a Geli would understand, well, sure, it's freedom, but it's my pure freedom to submit, which might seem like a paradox, but he's freely making the decision to submit.
Yes, exactly.
So did he have much of a relationship with what we might consider institutional Islam, or was he spending much more time with the with the guide.
He didn't have much relationship with institutional Islam, because at this point in Egypt, institutional Islam was changing.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have the modernizing state, and the modernizing state, late 19th century modernizing state, wants to get its hands on everything. And also is trying to modernize and rationalize itself. So what's happening to the Islamic establishment in Egypt at this point is that it's becoming less and less independent and more an arm of the state's modernizing, Europeanizing project. And Akeli does not like that at all. And he's actually quite critical of this in his journalism. And people like his Sufi master are the, at that point, correctly, he's right in seeing them at this point, they're the outsiders. Mm-hmm. They were the establishment, but now they're the outsiders. And the pure monotheism of Sufism is the outsider, and the Islamic establishment is becoming more and more Protestant. He doesn't actually say that, but I'm sure he wouldn't say that. But the real irony here is he's working against the establishment, if anything. But who is he working with?
Mm.
And I really do not know whether he really knew what he was doing here. I think he must have. I think he must have. And this is real art, because he was working for a newspaper. He wrote most of it, which was being financed by the Italian government.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why was the Italian government financing an anti-colonial, pro-Sufi newspaper published in Egypt, in partly in Arabic and partly in Italian? I am afraid because part of their imperialist expansionist project involved trying to get outsiders, religious outsiders on their side, on the Italian side, to use them to form an alliance with them against the established imperial powers. Not because they didn't like imperialism, because they wanted to be more successful imperialists themselves.
Mm.
Now, the bit that everybody knows about this policy isn't actually about the Italians, but everybody's seen Lawrence of Arabia, I think. And what is going on there is that the British are using a sort of traditional religious leader to get at the Ottomans.
Mm.
Now, what is generally forgotten is that the Brits were not the first people to play that game in that part of the world. 8 years before the start of the First World War, the Italians have formed an alliance with a traditional religious figure just a little bit south of where Lawrence of Arabia ends up. And he is a Sufi, and the contacts with him, and he rebels, they get him to rebel against the Ottomans, and the contacts with him are partly made through Cairo, and they are partly made through a group which Akeli was part of. There's a photograph of him this summer. So, in the event, what actually happens is that this rebel, Italian-sponsored rebel Sufi, during the First World War, the British say, well, you know, we're dealing with the guy up north. Should we take him over? Because Italy and Britain are on the same side, right? Mm-hmm. And the Italians say, okay. So he ends up in the same sort of game.
I see.
As the Sharif Hussein and Lawrence of Arabia and stuff. So anyhow, I mean, what does Ergeli think he's doing? Hanging out with Italian secret agents. Does he know they're secret agents? I mean, no, there's this photograph, group photograph. It's in the book. There's a group photograph, and there he is smiling.
Mm-hmm. What do you think he was doing?
I don't know. Perhaps he really thought that Italy as a colonial power would be completely different from the Brits and French.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, he died, you know, he died before the First World War had ended, so he never lived to see what came of all that.
Mm. That's an interesting question there. I mean, that is sort of, it's just tangential to this, because it, you know, you mentioned that you're seeing Islam possibly being sort of changing at this point in Egypt and I guess in the world as possibly being pulled into sort of modernity, rationalization. But it seems to me that Islam as a religion has been one, if not, now, you know, I'll put myself in this position saying this, the only one that really into the modern world has managed quite, not, I don't want to say forcefully, but with a very stern position to retain a very visible identity. Is that if that's something you agree with, why do you think that might be? Because it just seems connected to this change that's ongoing in Ergeli's lifetime.
No, I mean, Islam has certainly maintained a very visible identity. But I mean, I think what's happening, you know, we talk about Islam as if it's one thing, and of course, there, you know, one of the strengths of Islam in some ways is how varied it is.
Mm.
You know, everybody, there are certain essentials that everybody agrees on, but you know, beyond this, there are various other there are various options, and I mean, it's also the whole Sufism thing is, you know, not all Muslims are Sufis.
Mm.
There are different sorts of Sufi. So the question then is you know, which sorts of Islam are to the fore? And I mean, certainly the Islam that was the understandings of Islam that were on the up in the post-First World War period were very interested in society and organization and strength and resistance, and not terribly interested in mysticism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what, if there is such a thing, what does an Ergelian Islam look like? Could there be such a thing? Because from reading the book, of course, you have this anarchism, you have this leaning towards a more esoteric view, but you also have humanist and somewhat feminist attitudes. So what would an Ergelian Islam be considered if it could be a thing?
First, an Ergelian Islam would be very much mystically oriented, would be very Sufi. Secondly, an Ergelian Islam would be very open to other readings of the same pure monotheism, of the same reality. Ergelian Muslims would be reading Swedenborg. Thirdly, it would be quite anti-imperialist. I think that's the point, that by the way, that he was working with Italian imperialists, but he wasn't thinking he was working for, he was thinking he was working against. And that was British imperialism. So Hegelian Islam would be quite anti-imperialist, quite anti-establishment, quite in favor of the survival of more mystical forms of Islam. The positions that it would take, I'm not totally sure what positions it would take on women, because, you know, the whole thing has changed so fast that, you know, something which is progressive at breakfast time is old hat at tea time.
Mm-hmm.
It would be a very environmentalist Islam. He didn't really get in. I mean, there wasn't much environmentalism there, but he was one of the earliest people to take action in favor of animal rights. And that, I think, would nowadays, it wouldn't just be animal welfare, it would be environmentalism as well. So I think those would be the major elements of Hegelian Islam. And you can find Muslims like that. You can find groups like that today.
Mm-hmm.
So and of course, one of the reasons that you can find groups like that today is that this is the direction in which traditionalism is pushed.
I was about to say, where does traditionalism and Genon come into all of this? This is one of the key reasons we would also know of Ageli is because of this connection.
Absolutely. So yes, I mean that's I think in some ways Ageli taught Hegelian Islam to Genon.
mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's, we know very little about the relationship between those two.
Mm-hmm.
One thing we do know is that Guénon never realized that Hegeli was a Swede.
Would that have changed things?
I mean, Guénon thought it was very important to have a direct transmission of esotericism, of esoteric initiation from the source.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought that this fascinating man, Abdul Hadi Laqili, or sometimes he called himself Abdul Hadi al-Maghribi, who had come from Cairo, who knew Arab. if he'd been told that he came from Sweden, later on, after Hegeli was dead, somebody evidently did tell Guénon that he was a Swede, because Guénon constructed this bizarre explanation. He decided that Hegeli must have been a Tartar.
Right.
And how does a Tartar become a Swede? Well, perhaps he was born in Finland under Swedish rule. So, yes, that sort of explains things. Except that Guénon was obviously good at many things, but he wasn't that good on Finnish history,
mm-hmm.
because Sweden lost Finland in 1809.
So he was quickly trying to save face.
Yes. So I think, Hegeli was clearly born after 1809, so that one didn't really work. Okay, fine. This is not the main point. The main point is that although we know very little about the relationship between the two men, and it's completely bizarre that Guénon is not realizing that the man he's dealing with is actually a Swede. What you can see is that the two of them are writing in this short-lived monthly newspaper, which loses in the two years or so that it exists, it loses most of its other contributors. So in the final issues, it's just Gaynor and Argelia writing the whole thing between the two of them, and then publication stops. And Argelia gives up and goes back to Egypt. Mm-hmm. But you can see them, and they are putting together the ideas that they have both come with.
Mm-hmm.
And in Argelia's case, it's not just the ideas, it's his own knowledge of Sufism.
Mm.
So this is the point. I mean, Gaynor up to this point, he's been hanging out in these weird and wonderful occultist circles in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
And it's during this period when he knows Argelia, is evidently talking to him, certainly publishing him and so forth. It's at this period that Gaynor starts getting serious.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That the weird and the wonderful, which is characteristic of that occultist scene, drops away,
mm-hmm.
and he starts focusing on real, what he calls Oriental traditions, and the real Oriental tradition that he's learning all about in this period, mm-hmm. is Sufism, and he's learning about it from Argelia, and he's taking from Argelia not just a real understanding of a real tradition, but he's also taking from Argelia a very Sufi idea of the relationship between the esoteric and the exoteric.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's in Arabic, there's a pair of Batin and Zahir, which has almost exactly the same meaning.
Mm.
As esoteric and exoteric in English, which is quite unusual because, you know, with very different languages, very different civilizations, very often big terms do not really translate properly.
Mm-hmm.
But these two pairs match very neatly. And there's been a discussion going on in Islam for 1,000 years about the relationship between the esoteric and the exoteric. That's to say, the relationship between Sufism and mainstream Islam that everybody follows. And occasionally, one of the reasons this discussion has been going on for so long, is that occasionally you get Sufis who are being countercultural.
Mm-hmm.
Who needs the exoteric? But that one tends to end in tears.
Mm-hmm.
And the majority view has always been, and restated and restated and restated, the majority view has been that the important thing is the esoteric, but the esoteric has to be within a proper exoteric framework.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you say this in Arabic as a Sufi, it's completely uncontroversial.
Mm-hmm.
If you then say it in French to Gaynor, as Argelia obviously did, mm-hmm. and Gaynor says, yes, okay, so we have an esoteric metaphysics in an exoteric framework,
mm-hmm.
and there you've got half of traditionalism.
Mm-hmm. So it's obviously, you have this period in Gaynon's life where he's mucking around with occultism and French spiritualism and all this. What would have been, so the key difference for him would be, you know, with occultism just meaning hidden, there isn't really this exoteric layer in your sort of, I don't know, mucking around with all kinds of different stuff, which doesn't seem to have that coherent exoteric layer. So this move through to an understanding of esoteric as that deeper hidden, but hidden within an external, that was of key importance to him, to have that
contained with it.
Yeah, yeah. But that container then is the thing which is, I guess, for Gaynon, the tradition which is moving throughout, you know, history. It's not
tradition. The primordial tradition is the esoteric.
Okay.
So when we're calling it traditionalism, we're referring to the primordial tradition, which is the esoteric. That we find in Sufism, that Argelia found in Swedenborg, that Gaynor himself found in Vedanta, and that another friend of his found another guy in the group in this same period found in Taoism.
Mm.
So that's Agelli as well as Guénon. Mm. I mean, Guénon, I don't think was as keen on Swedenborg as Agelli was, but the principle that if we look at the non-European traditions, it's all there and it's clear and it's in agreement.
Mm. So in a sense, Guénon found from Agelli not only the beginnings of traditionalism as he then would espouse that as you know, traditionalism, but he also found tradition.
Exactly. Exactly. And he didn't, I mean, this isn't immediately obvious because Guénon never wrote much about sofas. Right? So that's in this first journal, it's Agelli is writing about the sofas.
Mm-hmm.
So Guénon never really fancies himself as an expert on Sufism. But he begins to see Advaita in somewhat Sufi terms. And the whole basic, as I say, the whole basic idea, this structural idea of the esoteric and the exoteric, looks very much as if it really comes from Agelli.
I see.
Well, of course, modern traditionalism isn't quite like that, because traditionalism works on two pairs. The traditionalism, mature traditionalism of the 1930s, 40s, 50s, long after Agelli's death. It's got the two pairs. It's got the esoteric-exoteric pair, and it has the modernity-tradition pair.
Mm.
And if you look at what's going on in the world today, the most prominent traditionalists are people like Alexander Dugin, who are political guys. And Dugin has said more or less explicitly, the cool thing about traditionalism is the modernity of tradition. Dugin quite likes the esoteric exoteric pair, but he doesn't use it that much. And some of the other political guys who are influenced by traditionalism, they really couldn't care less about the esoteric exoteric. It's the modernity tradition that they find useful.
So, in relation to Guénon and Agelli, then there seems to be a key difference. So they're both in agreement with the esoteric and exoteric, but Guénon moves more towards tradition, and Agelli seems to have a lot of what we, for his day, would have been considered modern views.
Yes. Yes, indeed. I mean, modern views, depending slightly what we mean by modern, because, of course, what Guénon means by modern is not tradition. That's to say, not grounded in metaphysics, not esoteric. But I mean, here between the mature Guénon and the younger Agelli, there would be a definite disagreement about hierarchy, because for Guénon, societies are naturally, traditionally, metaphysically structured around hierarchies. And you can't get less hierarchical than anarchism. And you can't get very much less hierarchical than feminism either, because feminism is challenging one of the most ancient hierarchies that there is. So, as I see it, Agelli sort of injects this super important understanding of esoteric, exoteric, and also of the importance of living non-Western traditions like Sufism. He injects that into Sufism, into traditionalism, and then goes off and gets run over by a train. And Guénon and friends then develop this and add in some other ideas and end up with the mature traditionalism, which has these political applications, which are, of course, in the opposite direction, because, you know, Ageli was not far right.
Clearly.
Whereas a lot of the contemporary traditionists are.
So do you think if it was that Ageli and Guénon never met, we probably wouldn't be talking about Ageli? I mean, why is he overlooked?
I mean, he's overlooked partly because people think he's a minor Swedish painter.
That's unfortunate.
And, you know, because... And the thing is, because he's remembered, because people say, oh, he's Ageli, the minor Swedish painter, in some ways it'd be better if all his paintings had been lost. And people would say, Ageli who? Oh, the guy who wrote on esotericism. then we might recognize his importance more easily. But no, I mean, without Guénon, I wouldn't be very interested in Ageli. But without Ageli, would there be a Guénon to be interested in? Would there be? I mean, you know, there'd still be a Guénon. But would anybody have heard of him? Mm-hmm. Would he just be a minor figure in 19th century occultism? Could we have had traditionalism without Ageli?
Do you think so?
I think we couldn't. I don't think we could have had traditionalism without Ageli. And then a lot of things fall out.
In a way, that's quite an incredible heritage, even though it's basically unknown and he didn't know he was doing it. If such is the case, that without him, traditionalism wouldn't have been. I mean, that's quite a sort of cog in the gears of history.
Yeah, but I think, I mean, you know, this is how it happens, isn't it? I mean, you know, people die hungry thinking they're failures.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, 100 years later, they're the best known, you know, they're in the top 15 best known painters or the top 15.
Where would you advise people to begin with Ageli? I'm going to assume the Bloomsbury collection.
Yeah, I mean, I don't, especially if you're reading in English, I don't know where else to begin. And I mean, if you can then go further, there are lots of places to go. I mean, there's this amazing, big, thick, beautifully printed 2-volume Life and Letters published in the 1940s in slightly old-fashioned Swedish.
It's quite difficult to approach that one. So if you know Swedish, there's another place to go.
Yeah, not everybody can approach that one. I mean, I sort of read Swedish, but I wish it was in a more modern version of the language when I come to myself. But it's beautifully printed and, you know, beautifully bound and strongly recommended from that perspective. But limited accessibility. I mean, there is. I mean, as I said, you know, this is something I've been wanting to do for years, and it marked the anniversary of his birth, 150th anniversary of his birth. And I don't think I'm going to be doing much more on him myself, but there is a lot more to be done. I mean, there's a nice archival collection in at the National Library in Sweden. If you can puzzle through lots of correspondence in French, of course, because that was where he lived most of his life.
Well, yeah, I'll be sure to put the links for the book in the description below. And you are currently, I'm going to assume that you finished the book on traditionalism because it's being published in next month.
Yep, that's the idea.
Is it? And I'm going to assume Ageli, does he appear?
He does a bit. But I mean, the new book is really looking at all the different areas where traditionalism has been applied,
mm-hmm.
Including, for example, environmentalism,
mm-hmm.
and which again, I wouldn't even know what environmentalism was. And it's also trying to set all these ideas in their broader context, mm-hmm. which has produced for me some quite interesting conclusions. So, for example, here am I trying to put certain discussions about art
mm-hmm.
in their context, and I have to sort of, you know, set the ground bit by referring to Ruskin. And then I suddenly discover actually that it's not just me who's been reading Ruskin. It looks as if the traditionalists have been reading Ruskin because you get the same views and so forth repeated there. Mm-hmm. So it's actually, in some ways, traditionalism turns out to be a bit more mainstream
mm-hmm.
than I had thought.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully you'll appear again on the podcast to discuss that when it's published and released. But I'll be sure to put the links for Anarchist Artist Sufi in the links below. And yeah, Mark Sedgwick, unless there's anything you'd like to add, it's been a great conversation.
No, great conversation for me too. I hope you liked the pictures as well.
Thanks very much.